You're listening to the FQXI podcast.
Today, astronomers tracking high-energy neutrinos at the South Pole help solve a mystery about the particle's cosmic origins.
So it brings information from that part of the universe to us. And it's so amazing that that tiny particle can actually have this much energy.
While physicists monitoring neutrinos at the Mini-Boon experiment find hints at the existence of new physics.
So that now starts to make it harder to just dismiss Mini-Boon as, oh, it was a mistake, which is kind of what, you know, people would like to do, but, you know, you come back around to this saying, well, wow, they got the same answer.
Could weird stringy objects called fuzzballs replace black holes?
So in fact, the entire interior of the black hole, all the stuff up to the horizon, is not empty space with a central singularity, but it's actually full of stuff.
Developing an almost quantum theory.
I think that it will happen eventually with quantum mechanics. One day somebody will conduct an experiment that will not admit an explanation in terms of quantum theory. And then what?
And testing free will in the lab with AI.
You could also imagine such a computer system reproducing itself with the help of a 3D printer, in analogy to humans bringing a child to life. And such a system could potentially show the qualitative features of free will.
She's Zia Morali.
And he's Brendan Foster.
Welcome to the podcast from the Foundational Questions Institute.
We're diving right in with the news that over the past few weeks, neutrinos have been solving some mysteries while raising new ones.
Neutrinos are tiny, almost massless elementary particles that interact only very weakly with other matter, which makes them tough to detect. They travel at close to the speed of light and are thought to come in three varieties or flavors: the electron neutrino, the muon neutrino, and the tau neutrino.
We'll talk more about whether particle physicists may have discovered a fourth flavor called the sterile neutrino in a few moments. First, though, I caught up with Azadeh Kivani, an astrophysicist now at Columbia University in New York, who is a team member on the IceCube Neutrino Observatory, which has detectors at the South Pole waiting to pick up signs of neutrinos that visit Earth from other galaxies. In July, the IceCube collaboration announced that for the first time, they had tracked some speedy neutrinos back to their source, a blazar emitting high-energy matter from a distant galaxy. Kivani explained to me how they were able to do this, despite neutrinos being so difficult to grab hold of.
Most of the neutrinos just pass through the Earth without interacting, but some of them, a very tiny fraction, would interact inside of our planet. So one way that we decided to do this was with the IceCube Neutrino Observatory, which is actually a gigaton detector located at the South Pole. So in order to detect these neutrinos, we use a cubic kilometer of ice that is already there at the South Pole. So we didn't need to buy the material. We already had ice molecules and ice over there at the South Pole. So we decided to build sensors and detectors and insert them in the ice in order to capture these neutrinos.
Okay, so when neutrinos from a distant galaxy pass through the Earth, occasionally one will be picked up in the block of ice detectors at the South Pole. But how do the astrophysicists work out just from that where the neutrino originally came from? Here's Kivani.
So since these particles are chargeless, they don't get deflected by magnetic fields and they are not absorbed by any particles in the universe. So if they are produced somewhere in, let's say, a certain galaxy, they can travel all the way without being attenuated or absorbed or any other interactions. So it brings information from that part of the universe to us. And it's so amazing that that tiny particle can actually have this much energy. So the energy that they can carry is as much as like an energy in, say, a golf ball. So if someone hits the golf ball and it hits you, you can imagine how much energy it has actually transferred to your body and you can feel it. So imagine that golf ball is big and you can see it, but the neutrino is too small. Actually, the smallest particle in the universe can carry that much energy and come all the way from billions of light years away, which is really exciting. So we study them, we look at their location, we trace them back and see what's going on in the other part of the universe to study the universe around us and discover about other parts of the universe.
So because neutrinos aren't deflected by magnetic fields, they travel to Earth in a straight line, and you can tell which direction they came from. But there's still a bit of detective work to find out their exact source, with extra clues coming from other independent telescopes and observatories searching for different types of particles and signals. This is called multi-messenger astrophysics, and it involved IceCube sending an alert to other telescopes in real time when they spotted an exciting candidate neutrino with information about the direction from which it was coming. Then it was up to other astronomers to jump in and help trace its source. Kivani played an instrumental role in setting up the communications network, which is hosted at Penn State University, where she used to work.
So as soon as a neutrino arrives, we send the alert to the astronomical community in less than a minute. So as soon as they get the alert, they start looking at the direction of the neutrino to see if there is anything going on at that point. The other observatories, such as NASA satellites, the Fermi satellite, the SWIFT satellite, that they are sensitive to gamma rays and X-rays, they can quickly follow up the location. So these are the satellites, but there are also telescopes on the ground that they can quickly slew to the direction that IceCube has sent and observe that part of the sky. And the good thing is that all these telescopes are sensitive to a variety of wavelengths, so each of them is sensitive to one wavelength or one particle.
In the latest study, when IceCube gave the alert, the SWIFT telescope was one of those that responded, searching the direction of the neutrino's incoming path for any sources of X-rays and also for ultraviolet and optical light. Kivani was leading the effort to analyze this new data, and she and her colleagues found 9 X-ray sources clustered together in a circle. They thought that the one at the center was the most likely source of the high-energy neutrinos, but they still needed more information from NASA's Fermi telescope, which looks for gamma rays.
One of them was very close to the center, which was very interesting, but at the time we couldn't say anything. So 2 days later, Fermi Large Area Telescope could see gamma rays from that location. But the gamma ray, comparing to historical data, the data that they took in previous months, was actually showing a flare, showing that the object over there is a known active galactic nucleus that is emitting gamma rays, or a blazar. So the blazars are actually active galaxies that they have a supermassive black hole in the center, and matter is rotating so fast around this supermassive black hole and sending the particles of light in a very energetic jet going from two sides of the disk, perpendicular to the disk, and one of these jets is pointing exactly towards us on Earth. So we can detect a lot of particles and light. So there were a lot of optical telescopes that started to observe the location in order to estimate the distance to the blazar. And they finally, one of them could observe the distance to the blazar, and we figured out that it was about 4 billion light years away.
So there you have it. The neutrinos came from a blazar. They were shot out towards Earth from a high-speed jet of matter emanating from the neighbourhood of a supermassive black hole at the centre of a distant galaxy about 4 billion light-years away. But just what mechanism is producing all this activity is still unknown. So there are plenty more puzzles left to solve for astrophysicists studying speedy neutrinos from the heavens.
Meanwhile, back at the lab... meanwhile, neutrinos closer to home are raising new questions, too, as physicists working on the mini-boon experiment at Fermilab outside Chicago announced in June. Neutrinos usually come in 3 flavors, electron, muon, and tau, and switch back and forth between them. In the late 1990s, Physicists working on the LSND experiment at the Los Alamos National Laboratory claim to see hints of a fourth neutrino, a sterile neutrino. This neutrino only would have a slight gravitational effect on other matter, but it would not interact in any other way. Physicists have been interested for a long time in the possibility that sterile neutrinos could be candidates for dark matter, explaining the origin of the bizarre invisible matter that seems to make up much of the matter in the universe. But LSND's experiment hadn't been independently replicated, and their sterile neutrino hadn't been spotted since.
Not until now, that is. Over at Fermilab, Minnie Boone's physicists set out to see if they could independently detect sterile neutrinos. They do seem to have found a strange candidate particle that fits the bill. They haven't seen a sterile neutrino directly. What they actually saw in their detector is a surprisingly large number of electron neutrinos. Their belief is that some muon neutrinos shapeshifted into sterile neutrinos, which in turn transformed into electron neutrinos, explaining the unexpected higher number of electron neutrinos. I called one of the lead researchers, Richard Vanderwater of Los Alamos National Laboratory, earlier, and he told me what they saw.
So the signature that we're looking for is a muon neutrino oscillating into an electron neutrino. So you're looking for a very small signal, a fraction of a percent. You can predict what are the number of electron neutrinos you would see. And in this case, we saw more electron neutrinos than were predicted.
So one reason for this strange excess of electron neutrinos could indeed be that some muon neutrinos changed first to sterile neutrinos and then to electron neutrinos. But could there be any other explanations? Here's Vanderwater.
Yeah, no, that's a very good question. And I'm not completely convinced it's sterile neutrinos either, because there are other models. There are some pretty exotic models, you know, people talking about extra dimensions. And so there could be something else. May not be sterile neutrinos. It could be some other physics, some new particle production, or a heavy sterile neutrino that's not oscillating but decaying. So there has been some effort into thinking of other possibilities. But because LSND started with the sterile neutrino model, that's the one that we use Miniboon to test. And this is another important point. Now you have two experiments when tested under this particular model get the same answer. You know, the number of events we're seeing is what we'd expect from LSND when you project out, and the shape, the energy shape. So, you know, if it's a background or a mistake, then, and because these two experiments are completely different, they both have to have then completely different mistakes, and the odds of that are starting to get small. So that now starts to make it hard to just dismiss Miniboon as, oh, it was a mistake, which is kind of what, you know, people would like to do, but, you know, you come back around to this saying, well, wow, they got the same answer. But you're perfectly right. It may not be sterile neutrinos. It could be some other physics. We need more experiments now to really kind of understand. And the best way to do that is with two detectors at different distances and show that you see a difference in the appearance of the electron neutrinos as a function of distance. Then that would be smoking gun proof that, aha, this is sterile neutrinos.
Thank you to Richard Vanderwater and Azadeh Kivani for first clearing up and then causing some more confusion about the elusive and ethereal neutrino.
On the podcast page, www.fqxi.org/community/podcast, we're posting links to news articles about those two results.
Now, Kivani mentioned that the source of her ice cube neutrinos was a jet of particles ejected from matter collecting on the outside of a supermassive black hole at the center of a distant galaxy. Matter that has not crossed its event horizon and been swallowed up by the black hole. Now, we've talked a lot about black holes in previous editions of the podcast. Physicists believe that these house an infinitely dense core called a singularity that draws anything unlucky enough to cross its event horizon inwards to its doom. Or does it? Do black holes even exist? String theorist Samir Matur of The Ohio State University thinks not, and that we should replace black holes with fuzzballs.
What balls?
Fuzzballs. According to Matur, According to Matur, fuzzballs could remove the need for singularities, resolve the famed information paradox about the fate of matter that falls into black holes, and would rewrite the story of the Big Bang. Reporter Sophie Hebden caught up with Mateur to find out more about why he thinks these tangled balls of string are lurking in the skies.
Why are black holes such interesting places? It's because they're places where the rules break down. The physics that describes motion in space-time under gravity, Einstein's equations of general relativity, and the physics that determines behaviour at the very tiny scales, quantum mechanics, both of these can't describe what's going on at a black hole singularity, where density goes to infinity in an infinitesimally small space. Fuzzballs could help solve some of these problems. Not only do they get rid of black hole singularities, they also resolve a long-standing paradox about black hole event horizons that was first pointed out by Stephen Hawking in 1974. Hawking's paradox arises due to quantum effects near a black hole event horizon that causes it to radiate photons and other particles until the black hole evaporates completely. But this would destroy information that was contained in the black hole, violating the rules of quantum mechanics that say information can't ever be destroyed. I asked Samir Mathir, who came up with the idea of fuzzballs and is based at The Ohio State University, to explain how fuzzballs improve on our picture of black holes.
The traditional picture of the black hole was such that all the mass in the black hole was sucked into the center and the rest of the black hole was empty space, just the vacuum. And that is the picture which leads to Hawking's information paradox. What the fuzzball paradigm actually showed us is that the black hole is actually not like this at all. So in fact, the entire interior of the black hole, all the stuff up to the horizon, is not empty space with a central singularity, but is actually full of stuff. And in fact, all the information of the hole is distributed all over this region, just the way the information in the Earth is distributed in a ball all the way throughout the Earth up to the Earth's surface. So in that sense, the fuzzball became really a description of the black hole in the same language as we would describe any other object like a planet as far as a matter of principle was concerned.
Fuzzballs are computed in string theory, which is a successful theory of quantum gravity in that it marries gravity with quantum mechanics. String theory depicts all particles as one-dimensional strings that can stretch and join onto one another to form new sorts of particles, and in the case of black holes, they are billions of strings that fluff up into these fuzzballs that have a tangible size.
In string theory, if you try to put together a lot of strings and braids and other things and bind them together to make a heavy object, the object does not actually shrink to a point in the center, but actually expands with the more the number of particles you put in it, the bigger it becomes. And in fact, if you see what size it acquires, it's as big as the entire structure, the entire size of the horizon. So in the beginning, we started by just getting an estimate of this size. That was way back in 1997, and it was very interesting that the size always came out to be the size of the horizon. After that, we started looking at the actual individual constructions of these strings and brains one by one, and in each case it turned out that we always got a fuzzball which has no horizon, as opposed to getting the traditional picture of the black hole where all the mass got sucked to the center. And I think now it's clear that you cannot explain the properties of black holes if we don't have a theory where the number of particle species actually grows with the energy the way it does in string theory. And the same thing comes out and explains the resolution of the information paradox, because if you put a lot of energy into stretchable objects, these objects stretch and become bigger. And the more energy you put in it, the larger this clump becomes, and so as it turns out, it's always so big that it cannot collapse to a point and create a horizon. And when there's no horizon, there is no information paradox. So there are some very generic lessons that have come out of string theory, which have allowed us to solve these long-standing paradoxes, and I don't think any other approach to quantum gravity has had this kind of success.
Mathur and his colleague Ali Masomi at Tufts University have used an FQXI grant to apply the fuzzball idea to look at even more challenging horizons, cosmological horizons. Their results for the Big Bang are interesting, not least because the fuzzball Big Bang might not need cosmic inflation. The theory of exponential expansion of space that happened immediately after the Big Bang that's used to account for the large-scale structure and even distribution of matter that we see in the universe today.
So in fact, we developed a picture which tries to tell you what happens as you follow the universe back closer and closer to the Big Bang. And the picture is very interesting. You may start with something which looks like one big fuzzball at any given time, let's say today. But as you go towards the past, this fuzzball breaks up into smaller balls. This is work I did with Ali Masumi, who was at Tufts. And as you go further and further towards the higher density situation towards the Big Bang, it breaks up into smaller and smaller pieces. So instead of having one singularity where all the mass comes into one place, it appears that it just keeps fragmenting into small local regions which then don't talk among each other. So you get a completely different picture of the singularity which you have near the Big Bang. So I think these kinds of things may give us a completely different way of asking about what's the meaning of a singularity. And it may not be a singularity of the kind that we always thought based on our traditional understanding of physics.
Yeah, would it mean that you didn't need a singularity, do you think?
Well, definitely it might completely change our picture of the singularity, but also it may change our picture of what exactly we need inflation for. Because one of the goals of inflation was to make sure that things became homogeneous on large scales. Now, if there were large scale effects coming out of quantum gravity, then there's a new source for effects which need to be taken into account in asking any of the basic questions of cosmology.
That was Samir Mator talking with reporter Sophie Hebden. You can read more about his ideas in an article by Sophie on the podcast page, www.fqxi.org/community/podcast. We're also adding links to news stories about fuzzballs, which have been causing a stir over the past few weeks. Now, from things that are almost black holes, but not quite, to
theories that are almost quantum, but not quite. Quantum theory explains the physics of the micro realm, but it brings with it a host of puzzles. For instance, particles can exhibit strange correlations, where they can influence each other instantaneously so that their properties match up across vast distances. Reporter Colin Stewart has been finding out more from Miguel Navasquez, a physicist at the Institute for Quantum Optics and Information in Vienna, Austria, who wants to find a deeper framework of reality that doesn't remove these spooky correlations, but actually encompasses even more.
Miguel Navasquez is a theoretical physicist at the Institute for Quantum Optics and Quantum Information in Vienna. He was inspired to pursue fundamental questions in physics when he fell in love with quantum mechanics. But now he's working to bring down the theory. I started our Skype chat by asking him why he thinks there might be a deeper reality beyond the quantum world.
The main reason why I think it's important to think beyond quantum theory is historical, is because every theory that we have proposed so far to describe the universe had been refuted. I think that it will happen eventually with quantum mechanics. One day somebody will conduct an experiment that will not admit an explanation in terms of quantum theory. And then what? Now, I would like to be in this point of history where somebody does this experiment and it falls upon my hands the task of building or finding some new theory that can explain. The problem is that I feel that I was born in the wrong time. I cannot do it. This experiment has not yet conducted. I'm sure that it will happen eventually, but it hasn't happened yet. So I got into this field because I wanted to say, well, I'm sure that this will happen at some point, right? And what could I say about this new theory? And just by thinking about what limitations or what features this theory should have already prompted me to get into foundations of quantum physics. And eventually that's what led me to postulate the theory of, the set of almost quantum correlations. At the time, everybody in the field was trying to recover quantum theory for first principles, and I thought that they would never succeed, because if you could, that would be the end of physics. You mean that it's over. We already got the theory that describes nature. But anthropologically speaking, I think that is very, very arrogant. I don't think that you will ever be at this stage. Why should some creature that evolved from small cells be able to comprehend the universe where they're living? But I think it's interesting to ask the question about what are the limits of the theory that describes the universe. I think this is a more reasonable question.
You've used the notion of correlations to explore an alternative to quantum theory. Can you tell us what you mean by a correlation?
When we want to picture this kind of scenarios, we imagine that we have two experimentalists. They are called Alice and Bob. And Alice has her own lab, and Bob has his own lab. And they're conducting experiments at the same time. They decide the type of experiment that they're going to conduct, and then they get an output. The output is the result of the experiment. It can be the measurement of the speed of a particle, or it can be just a bit. It can be either a zero or one. It can be simply whether the particle moves to the right or to the left. It could be that even though they're conducting experiments in different parts of the world, the measurements they're getting are correlated. It may be that whenever Alice detected her particle to move to the right, Bob also detects his particle to move to the right. there's a correlation between these two particles. That would mean ultimately that there was some connection between Alice and Bob before they conducted the experiment, because otherwise there shouldn't be any correlation between the labs. All the correlations that you can imagine are what we call classical correlations. They're correlations that you can prepare if you throw a dice many times, note down the results, and then pass the results to Alice and Bob. And then Alice and Bob decide which experimental outcome to announce, depending on the value of the dice at any point. Then that would explain why they are correlated, because at some point I threw these dice and then I distributed the results. That explains why Alice and Bob are correlations between the measurements. And that's the most general thing that you can do in classical theories. That's the most general correlation that you can generate. In quantum theory, you can do something else. What you could do is to create two particles in the same place and then give one of them to Alice and one of them to Bob. Now, Alice and Bob, in order to decide the outcomes of their experiments, what they can do is to measure these particles. They act with their experimental apparatus on each particle, and then they get some experimental result. The correlations that you can get, meaning the distribution of the two outcomes that they get, is something that in general you cannot explain classically. You cannot explain it by the mind that somebody was throwing dice and then distributing the results to Alice and Bob. This is the difference between quantum and classical physics at the level of correlations.
And you found some potential correlations beyond those associated with quantum theory?
We found a set of correlations, which is slightly bigger than the set of quantum correlations. We call it the almost quantum set. We call it like this because it is very similar in simple scenarios to the quantum set. And the interesting thing about this set is that all these correlations satisfy all physical principles that people had proposed in order to single out quantum theory. It is a set that is closed under composition. If you start combining different correlations, which are almost quantum, to obtain a new set of correlations, what you get is a correlation which is itself almost quantum. These two properties give us the idea that perhaps these correlations have these nice properties because actually they correspond to the correlations of a yet-to-be-discovered physical theory.
Just because the almost quantum correlations don't lead to any theoretical contradiction, isn't it a bit radical to suggest that they could be achievable in nature?
I'm doing the same thing that many physicists have done before me, right? I mean, the reason why people believed on the system of black holes before there was any observational evidence was because they were one solution of Einstein's equation in general relativity. Nobody had observed them, right? But it was a consequence of the theory. We could have added something to the theory in order to prevent the existence of black holes, which had never been observed. But we decided not to. We decided instead to try to explore and try to find them. Now there's some pretty good evidence of the existence of these entities, right? So in this case, I would like to do the same. I mean, you have the set of correlations, it seems to be logical. Why not postulate that these correlations could exist in the universe?
Why haven't these correlations ever shown up in any experiment performed to date?
Yeah, one possibility would be that because they are very, very similar, when you deal with scenarios in which you can conduct a small number of experiments and you have a small number of outputs. And these are the scenarios that have been tested in the lab. Another possibility could be that we don't know how to make the proper measurements, or we don't know how to prepare the particles in the right way.
Do you think we're over-reliant on photon experiments?
Quantum mechanics was a theory that was built for photons, for these kind of particles. But perhaps if you start conducting weird measurements in more exotic particles, you would get predictions which are not the ones that quantum theory makes.
How did you use your FQXI grant to explore the almost quantum set further? And what did you find?
The set of almost quantum correlations is based on physical theory. But at the beginning, we had problems with this theory because it was not clear that the set of correlations of this theory should be the set of almost quantum correlations or whether it could contain also extra correlations, some correlations which are beyond the set of almost quantum correlations. And in the end, what we found is that, yes, actually, this theory contains correlations beyond the almost quantum set. And what we recently published is a result that says that this has to be necessarily the case. Any reasonable physical theory that contains the almost quantum set will also contain correlations beyond the almost quantum set. So there's a negative side. It implies that the set of almost quantum correlations is not the set of correlations of any reasonable physical theory. But on the other hand, there's also a positive side to all this story, because the almost quantum set has already inspired us some physical theory, which is definitely not quantum. It's supra-quantum. It is non-trivial, and it seems to be very rich. And in the future, I plan to investigate this theory to see if I could perhaps make some prediction.
Thank you to Miguel Navasquez for chatting with Colin Stewart there. And Colin has written an article profiling Navasquez research, which you can find on the podcast page, www.fqxi.org/community/podcast.
Well, this is a packed edition. Thank you for sticking with us thus far, assuming you had a choice.
Are you suggesting that listeners are being forced to stay tuned against their will?
No, I'm just pondering the philosophical question. of whether we even have free will at all. It's something philosophers have debated for years, but there seemed to be no way to settle the question. But Harvard physicist Avi Loeb argues that developments in artificial intelligence and machine learning could provide a way to experimentally test free will sooner rather than later. And as he explains to reporter John Farrell, it's a vital issue as moral responsibility rests on the assumption that we can freely choose our actions.
Well, in my mind, the free will is most fundamental because much of our ethical behavior is based on that. And, you know, we put people in jail because they have the ability not to do crimes in our mind. And we hold people responsible for what they do. And so the structure of society is pretty much founded on the idea that free will exists. In addition, even more importantly, we operate very often because we have the idea that we can shape reality in a way that reflects our wishes. And if we were to realize that we don't have that freedom of actually deciding about the future and shaping reality, then, you know, I, for one, would lose interest in not being motivated in shaping reality because what's the point, you know?
And right.
If we are just machines that operate by a combination of factors, then there is not much fun associated with it.
So although we can't trace the origin of free will directly to the behavior and motion of individual fundamental particles, some scientists suggest that free will might be an emergent phenomenon that arises due to the arrangement of neural networks in the brain.
I think that even if we find the answer that free will is an emergent phenomenon, it's not really fundamentally free will, I would still prefer to have the illusion of free will or give people the illusion of free will, because otherwise we lose much of our daily motivations.
Right.
So that's an interesting dilemma, that if we find scientifically that the truth, we might not want people to believe it because it will change the way they behave in a fundamental way that is not necessarily good. Nevertheless, I do think that there is a way forward in terms of addressing the question of whether free will exists.
Well then, would there be a way we could ever experimentally test whether free will is real or just an illusion?
One approach to doing so is artificial intelligence and machine learning. The recent developments in self-learning computer algorithms allow us to envision a future where a computer system can learn from experience and educate itself just like a human. And such a system could interact with the physical world around it if it has sensors of vision, sound, taste, smell, touch, just like a human. And you could also imagine such a computer system reproducing itself with the help of a 3D printer, in analogy to humans bringing a child to life.
Right.
And such a system could potentially show the qualitative features of free will in a fashion that would be indistinguishable from a human. And so if that happens, then it would imply that free will is an emergent phenomenon that results from putting together well-understood ingredients. You just need to put together these building blocks and construct a self-learning machine. And one experiment that one can do is, for example, change those building blocks and see how the results change, if there are predictable changes to the decisions of the system. It's sort of like an experiment where you change the conditions and you ask how will the system react to that.
Good. And what would that tell us?
One could potentially demonstrate that the will of the system is shaped by the design of its constituents. So one way of thinking about it is like a social scientist taking humans and putting them under different circumstances and seeing some patterns, and by that making a theory that predicts how humans would behave. But for a social scientist to do that, it's very complicated because humans are not isolated systems, and
right.
And they're very complex. But if we deal with computers, it's more traceable because we know exactly what we put into the computer and into the algorithm. And so there is a way forward here that is experimental, where you change the ingredients that you put into the algorithm and you see how the results change. Now, also, you know, sometimes playing with humans is not ethical, and here you can do whatever you want. There is no ethical code in dealing with computer algorithms.
That was Abraham, or Avi Loeb, talking to reporter John Farrell. On the podcast page, www.fqxi.org/community/podcast, we're linking to a piece that Loeb wrote for Scientific American, discussing this and other ways in which scientists are getting closer to testing big philosophical and spiritual questions, including how life originated and whether aliens exist.
And if you like those types of mind-boggling conundrums, you will also enjoy the new FQXI essay compilation, which brings together the winning essays from our Wandering Towards a Goal contest, which pondered how purpose and intention evolved in the biological world from directionless physical laws. There's a link to buy our latest book on the podcast page, too.
That's all we have time for today. Thank you again to Azadeh Kivani, Richard van der Water, Samir Mator, Sophie Hebden, Miguel Navasquez, Colin Stewart, Avi Loeb, and John Farrell.
As always, you can reach us by email at podcast@fqxi.org, on Twitter at FQXI, or on Facebook at FQXI Physics.
He's been Brendan Foster.
And she's been Zia Morali.
I'm off to switch neutrino flavors. Have you got something ringing in the background there? Or is it me?
Yeah, that's my door.
Oh, okay.
I'm off to check the door for fuzzballs.